I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. Today, a majority of U.S. states have legalized same-sex marriage, and all eyes are on the U.S. Supreme Court that will be issuing an important ruling on marriage equality any day now. Back in 2013, the court ruled on two important cases overturning the Defense of Marriage Act in the Windsor case and sending Hollingsworth v. Perry back to the California courts. The Perry case began in 2008 when California voters approved Proposition 8 declaring that marriage was legal only for heterosexuals. It was challenged and argued in what our guest calls one of the most powerful civil rights trials in American history. That's a quote from Kenji Yoshino's new book, Speak Now, Marriage Equality on Trial, The Story of Hollingsworth v. Perry. He analyzes the arguments in the trial and concludes that the courtroom is the right place to debate legal controversies that involve legislative facts. It's also a memoir about his own marriage and family. Kenji Yoshino is the Chief Justice Earl Warren Professor of Constitutional Law at New York University School of Law and joins us on Radio Times. Nice to have you back on the show.
Thanks so much for having me, Marty.
You're very welcome. Your book begins with your own marriage. This was the summer of 2009, performed by federal appellate judge Guido Calabresi. What did he tell you and your husband to be?
Yes. So at the time, I had just come off of being the Guido Calabresi Professor of Law at Yale Law School. So I literally had the chair that bore his name. And so this is a very significant moment for both me and my now husband. And Guido sat us down. This is someone I've known since I was a baby law student, you know, 1L law student who was my mentor and my sponsor all along the way. So he sat me and my husband Ron down and he said, "Every marriage until now that I've performed, I've said these words, by the power vested in me by the state of Connecticut and by the United States of America, I now pronounce you married." Then he said, "Every marriage I've performed until now has been a heterosexual wedding, and you're the first same-sex couple that I've married." Now, remember that this is 2009, so the Defense of Marriage Act, which says that for federal purposes, marriages between same-sex couples is not recognized, was still good law. It had not been struck down yet as it would be in 2013. So he said, "You know this, I know this. So as a technical matter, I can't say the second part. I can't say by the power vested in me by the United States of America, I now pronounce you married." But then he said, "I've slept on this. I've prayed on this. I've talked to my wife about this. And I just can't find it in my heart to treat you any differently from the way I've treated all of the opposite sex couples whom I've married. And so I'm going to leave the words in, but the understanding will be that I am marrying you solely under state law, right, in my capacity as a federal judge." So when I say by the power vested in me by the United States of America, it's because I'm a federal judge and everything I do is by the power vested in me by the United States of America.
I mean, it sounds like he was almost challenging his own status as a federal judge.
Exactly. You know, I think he was pushing at the very boundaries, right, of saying, you know, I'm caught in between what I know the law permits me to do and what my own personal convictions are. And in a classic lawyerly way, he found a way to thread the needle, obeying the law, while finding a way to say, you know, there's a difference between what I can do under state law and the position I hold as a federal judge.
So when the U.S. Supreme Court overturned the Defense of Marriage Act, did you then finally feel fully married?
Yes. You know, Ruth Bader Ginsburg had the greatest line about this, Justice Ginsburg in the Defense of Marriage Act case, where in the oral argument she said, "So let me get this straight. Like, you are married to the, you know, litigant," she said. You are married for purposes of state law, but you're not married for the purposes of federal law, right? And so what's going on here? Because this just seems like there are these full marriages where you're married for all purposes, which, you know, obviously opposite sex couples have. And then there are these sort of, she called them skim milk marriages.
Is that what she said?
Yeah. So she's, and that got a huge laugh from the court. You know, it was one of her best lines ever on the court, in my opinion. And it really stayed with me of thinking about, wow, I've never really deeply thought about this, in part because it's so painful to think about yourself as a second-class citizen in the country. So you sort of don't touch that. You don't go there, right? But when she said it, I thought, you know, this is something that's really important for me to keep in mind. And I have to tell you, Marty, that the day when the Defense of Marriage Act was struck down, which was also the day they decided the case I wrote the book about, I promptly went home to my husband and my family by prior agreement. And we all toasted, the four of us, because we have two kids, with whole milk. Right, because we thought, finally, our skim milk marriage has been converted to whole milk. And I also sent to a producer friend of mine who is gay, actually a TV anchor who is gay, who I knew was married, a carton of whole milk. And I was going to be on a show later that day, and so I thought I'd be there to be able to explain it to him. And I wasn't. I got bumped off his show. And I thought, oh my gosh, he's just going to get this random carton of whole milk and have no idea like why I sent it to him, and I'll never, you know, be invited back on a show again because he was this lunatic who's sending me, you know, beverages of various kinds for no apparent reason whatsoever.
Milk as metaphor, right?
Milk as metaphor.
Well, as I said in the introduction, you know, the country is waiting to see what the court does with this Obergefell v. Hodges case. And this is whether states have to recognize same-sex marriages that have been performed and are legal in other states. You were at the court earlier this year. You heard some of the arguments. You know, this is the tea leaf analysis of how the justices may rule. Any sense one way or the other, even looking at what they did in the Windsor case?
A very strong sense. So you're absolutely right, just to set the table here a little bit. What we saw in Windsor was the court saying, if you have a marriage under state law, then the federal government can't deny you benefits for that valid state marriage. But they didn't, in 2013, reach the question of whether all 50 states had to recognize same-sex marriages. Now this is kind of ultimate stakes poker, where they're going to do all 50 states or not, and say either you have a constitutional right to be married in all 50 states, or you do not have the right, and then we'll have to go back to litigating this state by state. So did I have a sense? People who know me well would say that this is a weighty statement coming from me, because I'm usually very, very cautious and lawyerly and risk-averse about how much I infer from oral arguments. That, you know, anyone who does con law knows that it's a very dangerous thing. Constitutional law knows that it's a very dangerous thing to do, to infer too much from oral arguments. But I'm quite bullish. You know, I was very confident that I could count to five, which everyone says is the cardinal rule of Supreme Court litigation. And I could count the four liberals and Justice Kennedy for a majority. And then everyone says, do we have the chief or not? And I would not want to lay a wager on that one, right? But all we need is five.
And is it just the way they ask the questions, the kinds of questions, the follow-ups, the interruptions, the body language? Are all these things that go into making a Supreme Court decision of such magnitude?
Yes, I would say all of the things, but also their past track record, Marty, so that if you look at the 14th Amendment decisions that Justice Kennedy has written, many of the major— so the 14th Amendment is the home of both the liberty guarantee and the equality guarantee in the Constitution as relates to the states. And if you look at those decisions by Justice Kennedy, he has repeatedly, over and over again, ruled for gay rights. So whether that was a Romer case in 1996, that was a Colorado Amendment 2 case that sort of swept away protections for gay people in the state, or the 2003 Lawrence versus Texas case, which struck down laws criminalizing same-sex intimate conduct, as well as opposite-sex intimate conduct in the home, and then the Windsor case, which we were just talking about. He wrote the majority opinions in all of those. The four liberals, it was very clear, both from their votes and from what they were asking. So, you know, Sotomayor, Kagan, Ginsburg, and Breyer, it was very clear which way they were headed, I thought. And then Kennedy, based on all these past opinions, but also his questions. So what the media did, just to acknowledge that this is not a cakewalk, the media was reporting on how hard he was on the plaintiff's lawyers for the same-sex couples, like Mary Bonato, who's the kind of Thurgood Marshall of our movement. And he was very hard on her, but I thought he was hard on her in the sense of acknowledging that there were two sides to this argument. Because on the one hand, he said, well, you're trying to change something through judicial fiat that has been around for millennia. But in the same question, he said, doesn't this opinion bear the same relationship to Lawrence as Loving versus Virginia bore to Brown, right? And Lawrence versus Texas is often called the Brown versus Board of the gay rights movement. Loving versus Virginia is obviously the 1967 case that struck down bans on interracial marriage. So at the point where you're analogizing Obergefell to Loving, can you really come out any other way, right, than for the plaintiffs. You know, if you really see that as an analogous move, right? It's very hard to say. I view this as, analogous to Loving, but, I'm going to vote in the other way than Loving went. And, it's just a very bizarre comment to make. And Loving was obviously 9-0 in favor of the interracial couples.
And even going back to the Lawrence case, Lawrence v. Texas case, I think that's what it was called, even Scalia, he wasn't happy with the decision, but even he seemed to say this opens the door to perhaps same-sex marriage or, a different version of or understanding of what marriage is about.
Exactly right. So he said, if moral disapproval of gay individuals is no argument to sustain a law against them, how could you possibly be against same-sex marriage? You couldn't say that it's because of the procreative capacity of opposite-sex couples to procreate internal to their union because the infertile and the sterile are permitted to marry. So he essentially, lay down the roadmap. This is a 2003 decision for same-sex marriage. And, I think essentially he was saying that if you believe in logic and principle, this is a natural outcome. And I think he's right.
What's interesting is most states do recognize same-sex marriage, but not because people voted for it. Same-sex marriage has become legal because the courts have gotten involved.
That's right. So, I do want to say that there have been certain instances like, the three referenda or, certain legislative votes in states like Vermont or New Hampshire where there have been legislative votes. But it was really the wave after Windsor, which was a 2013 case, where courts interpreted Windsor, again, in part because of a dissent that Scalia wrote saying the logic of this entails that, bans on state bans on same-sex marriage are unconstitutional, that created a flood of activity in the lower courts who just said we have to obey Supreme Court precedent.
And about a minute before a break here, and not to get ahead of ourselves, but you do say that the courts can be a place where we can argue out these issues because, of course, the question is raised, especially with California, people voted for it, the people spoke.
Yes. So I have two things to say about that. One is that constitutional rights should not be up for a popular vote. So we don't live in a pure democracy. There are limits to our democracy. And then the other one, which I hope we'll get to after the break, is there's a difference between where the most legitimate conversation is happening and where the best conversation is happening. And my book is really about the fact that the courts are the best place to have the conversation.
Well, let's take that short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. Kenji Ishino is our guest today on Radio Times. He's a professor of constitutional law at New York University School of Law, also author of a new book called Speak Now, Marriage Equality on Trial, The Story of Hollingsworth v. Perry. We're going to take a very short break and then begin to talk more about this important California case. To our listeners, I'm sorry to say our phone system is down, but you can certainly send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. I've been talking with Kenji Ishino about the U.S. Supreme Court same-sex marriage rulings 2 years ago having to do with marriage equality. And I do want to focus on your book again. It's about this particular case in California involving, it goes back to Proposition 8. And this was a referendum where the voters of California voted to say that marriage was exclusively for heterosexuals.
Exactly right.
And this was a huge campaign to get people to vote, I guess, one way or the other. How were they able to get a majority to vote on that?
Yeah. So, my book is not primarily about this, but, it's a great question. So let me take a stab at it. Yeah. So first of all, a huge amount of money was spent on both sides by this. So upwards of $40 million on each side. And it was the most money that had ever been spent on a social issue. Obviously, if roughly equal amounts of money were spent on both sides, it meant that one side was doing better messaging than the other. And I think that the thing that they did so well on the other side was to do a couple of things. One is to make it about children. So protect our children was the slogan. And it's really interesting how that slogan has drifted from the right end of the spectrum as a reason to be against same-sex marriage to currently being a reason to have same-sex marriage, because now the focus is, what about protecting the children of gay parents, right? And wouldn't their households be more stable if their parents were able to marry? But the other thing that I think that they did, Marty, and this is really relevant, and I was watching Ireland very closely based on this issue, is that the referendum process, which is just means a direct vote, like right. You just go in, you don't go through a legislature, you just go to your polling place and you pull a lever, right, is a way of getting around the separation of church and state that our Constitution requires. Because usually if you're in a legislative debate and you stand up and you say, I'm voting this way because God told me to, then, or, you know, less pejoratively, you know, because it's in keeping with my religious principles, that's not going to pass muster if a court looks at it and says that was the reason that the piece of legislation made it over the top. Whereas notice what happens if you have a referendum and you have religious convictions and you go to the voting booth. Nobody can police that because nobody knows why you're voting, right? So the kind of combination of religion and referenda is a really, really powerful combination. It's a way of doing an end run around the separation of church and state.
And you think that's why it was victorious in California then?
Yes. Let me just say that I have a little bit of data to support this, despite the fact that what happens in the polling booth is really up to the individual. In exit polls, right, CNN exit poll asks people about the correlation between their vote and how often they attended church. So 83% of people who attended church weekly said that they voted for Prop 8, namely against same-sex marriage. And 84% of people who said that they did not go to church voted against Prop 8. So there's a very, very high correlation in between frequency of church attendance and where you stood on the issue.
This is a case that ends up in federal court. Chief U.S. District Judge Vaughn Walker is the judge in this case. And you do say in this book that this is one of the most powerful civil rights cases in American history.
Absolutely. So, you know, as a constitutional law professor, we usually I'm not atypical, or I'm totally typical of my breed, in that we usually focus on Supreme Court opinions. We don't look at trial court opinions. But, you know, the way I came to write this book was that I saw Vaughn Walker's opinion when it was issued on August 4th, 2010. It was 136 pages long. There were 80 findings of fact. It looked like such a rich decision. So I asked my librarian, the poor thing, to lug up the 13 volumes of the trial transcript because I wanted to read the trial transcript. And I was mesmerized, Marty. This is like reading a novel. It's almost like reading Tolstoy or something like that, where you just flip open the first page and, you know, you wake up 3,000 pages later because you're so immersed in this, in the world of the text that you're reading in, And it was just such a transformative experience for me that I thought, you know, very few people are going to read this 3,000-page transcript, so I have to find a way to bring this to the reader. This trial deserves a life.
Well, on one side, the lawyers that opposed Proposition 8, actually famous combatants when it came to Bush v. Gore, this is Boies and Olson team up together to take on this case.
Yes, and one of the brilliant things about the trial was exactly that you know, you had the two lawyers who had faced off in Bush versus Gore. So David Boies was arguing for Gore, and Ted Olson was arguing for Bush. And so there were these major antagonists. And so you would think that they wouldn't necessarily get along that well. But they're really very, very close. And so I asked each of them, because I did about 40 interviews for this book, how that friendship came about. And they both had the same answer, which I thought was a really wonderful one, which is that when you are working on a case of that magnitude, where literally the country is at stake, right, and the future of the country is at stake, you get so deep into the weeds. This is now David Boies that I'm thinking of and paraphrasing, that no one will talk to you about the case anymore because everyone is so tired of hearing you talk about the case, except for your party opposite. So the only person who is in that case at the granular level at which you are in the case is your party opposite. So long after your wife has stopped talking to you about it, you know, your party opposite will talk to you about it. And so what he was saying is that after the case was over, he and Ted started vacationing together and talking to each other. They have such deep respect for each other.
Wow.
And they finish each other's sentences. So I once ribbed them by saying, if there's any kind of old married couple in this case, it's you two, because, you know, you literally are just like joined at the hip. You finish each other's sentences. You're so full of adulation for each other.
And on the other side, a pretty well-known Washington, D.C. lawyer, a guy named Charles Cooper.
Yes. Yeah, so Chuck Cooper is extremely able, you know, former Supreme Court clerk, founding partner of the firm Cooper & Kirk, just a terrific attorney. So, and I say this because not only because it's true, but also to say, you know, this trial might not have worked out as well if the other side had not been so ably represented. So, you know, there's certain preconditions. I'm not here incautiously raving about trials and saying every trial is a good thing. Sometimes an asymmetry in resources or the quality of the attorneys might make a difference. But in this case, both sides were very well funded and had kind of A-team attorneys representing their sides.
And what at issue was, in a sense, what is marriage? What is marriage for?
Yeah, that was one of the three buckets, I would say, of things that was being argued out. So the big favor that Chief Judge Von Walker did for the debate was to say, I want every contested issue in this case to be argued out. So one side was saying, oh, you know, Cooper's side was saying, you're not asking for the right to marry, you're asking for the right to same-sex marriage, and that's a new right, and the court doesn't recognize new rights unless they're deeply rooted in the nation's traditions and history. And obviously, no one was arguing that same-sex marriage was so deeply rooted. Ted and David answered by saying, you know, look, you know, we are not asking for a new right. We're a new group that's asking for a traditional right or an existing right. So when interracial couples asked to get married or when inmates asked for the fundamental right to marry, they weren't asking for the right to interracial marriage or the right to inmate marriage. They were asking for the right to marry. So there's a difference between a new group asking for an existing right and a new group asking for a new right, and we're the former, not the latter. To which Chuck responded, well, those other cases are distinguishable, which is legal speak for, you know, you can just set them off to one side, because in those cases, the inmates and the interracial couples could procreate internal to their unions, and procreative capacity is a central tenet of marriage. Like, that's what marriage is for, to assist and support procreation by the biological parents of the child. And Von Walker's take was like,
and well, that's the judge, Von Walker.
Yeah. And so Von Walker was like, I don't know who's right here. Like, I don't, like, I'm not a historian of marriage. Let's get some historians of marriage in here to tell us, like, what marriage is, because I don't want to just bloviate or opine about what marriage is. So what the right to marriage actually entailed was question number one. Question number two was, what does equal protection require, right? So regardless of whether or not there's a fundamental right to marry, if gay people have equal rights to straight people, what does that mean with regard to marriage? Do they have to be included within the institution or not? And then the final bucket was, assuming that the lowest level of review, meaning the highest level of deference, is required to Prop 8, which, as you say, was a democratic enactment of the people, what are the justifications? Because even under the lowest level of review, the state has to come forward with some hypothetical, colorable justification for why the legislation should be validated by a court. And so Cooper's side said, well, child outcomes are better for opposite-sex couples, or alternatively, same-sex marriage would deinstitutionalize or weaken, right, marriage for opposite-sex couples. And Von Walker's response was like, well, again, these seem like empirical debates. They don't seem like theoretical debate, so let's get individuals to testify on both sides about child welfare or about the deinstitutionalization point.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Kenji Yoshino, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. He's a professor of constitutional law at New York University School of Law, author of a new book called Speak Now, Marriage Equality on Trial, the story of Hollingsworth v. Perry. And this was a case that was argued about 5 years ago in California, having to do with same-sex marriage. And again, I'm sorry to say our phones are down, but you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at at WHYY Radio Times. I have to say, though, and you include a lot of the testimony and the cross-examination back and forth in this case, but it seems that the witnesses for the Charles Cooper side, the side that was arguing for Proposition 8, just sort of didn't have a leg to stand on a lot of these key issues about children, about what marriage is, about traditional marriage. There was a guy named David Blankenhorn. We've actually had him as a guest on Radio Times who talked about marriage. A number of people really had their credentials challenged as well. Is it that Boies and Olson were so good that they could take these people down, or was there a kind of inherent weakness on that other side?
Yeah, I don't think it was that David and Ted were so much stronger. You know, I think Chuck is a redoubtable lawyer who's argued in the Supreme Court multiple times, right? So, you know, I don't think that it was the lawyering that was at fault. I think that the case on one side was just a lot stronger and there wasn't much to be said on the other side. So then we have to get into the question of, well, if there wasn't that much to be said on the other side, then why is it that we've had, you know, bans on same-sex marriage for so long or an opposite-sex marriage definition for so long? And I think there are really two answers to that, tradition and religion. And what was so interesting about this court case is that tradition is not a reason, you know, to bring into court that is sustainable as a reason to, or rather, it's not a justification that is enough to sustain a law. So we have pre-existing precedent, but also just common sense tells us that you can't say that slavery is okay simply because we've had a long tradition of slavery, right? And then similarly, with regard to religion, as I've said earlier, the separation of church and state means that you can't bring those religious reasons into court. So once you sort of filter out those reasons, it's really hard to come up with reasons that stand up under the glare of any kind of judicial scrutiny. And the thing I loved about the trial, Marty, was that even in an academic debate, which I think many people think of as like the acme of rigorous debate, and if only it were, but even in academic debate, a smart person can run out the clock or pivot away from the question. And, you know, to be fair, I'm sure many of my opponents would say the same thing of me in debates. But, it's very frustrating to not be able to get a square answer to a question. But if you're in court under cross-examination and you're risking perjury if you lie and you have to answer the question and everything that you say is taken down in a transcript, then there's nothing else like it, Marty. You know, that John Wigmore, the great evidence scholar, used to say that cross-examination is the greatest legal engine ever invented for the discovery of truth. And I think that that's what we discovered in this trial, that when they had to hold up their hands and actually articulate their reasons that were not sounding in religion or in tradition, Cooper's side just didn't have enough to pass muster.
In fact, Cooper said, I think a number of times, I don't know. I mean, the judge would ask him a question. As you say, at least in court, you're supposed to tell the truth. I mean, I guess he was being truthful, but he was saying, I don't know. And these were important questions.
Yeah. And let me qualify that a little bit, Marty, because I always like leap strangely to Cooper's defense, having interviewed him and having, formed a bond with him. When Cooper said, I don't know, I mean, his claim was that what he was trying to say was, we don't know. We as a society don't know. And that it was kind of a slip of the tongue that he said I rather than we. And this got bruited abroad, I don't know, you know, as a really big talking point for the other side. I don't think that we need to put too much weight on that. I think that what he was saying was, we as a society don't know and we're allowed to proceed with caution, which was yet another justification that they had. I think that we can just, you know, rather than say, oh, he was flummoxed and he didn't have an answer, we can just say, well, let's look at the answers that he actually did give and let's look generously at the other side and see what answers they did give. The most generous interpretation of I don't know is really to say we don't know, right? And so the question becomes, is it permissible to have a wait-and-see attitude? And the answer that the court has repeatedly given us is no, it's not permissible to have that. That the court is a very passive body. It doesn't get to decide when cases come to it. But when cases do come to it, it can't sort of just throw up its hands and say it's more convenient for us to wait 50 years and to decide this question. It has to decide the constitutionality of cases when those cases arrive on their doorstep.
Were the lawyers, the Boies and Olson, were the lawyers able to say that same-sex marriage does not hurt heterosexual marriage? I mean, were they able to come up with evidence of that? Or the children raised by gay couples are no better or worse off than children raised by straight couples? Were they able to put that out, I guess, as evidence?
Yes, I thought they were able to do this in a really devastatingly powerful way, meaning that Boies and Olson were able to disprove both of those two justifications, which you're rightly fastening on as the two main justifications that Cooper led with. So with regard to the so-called deinstitutionalization point of, you know, a same-sex marriage is going to hurt an opposite-sex couple's marriage, you know, let's begin by saying it's a rather counterintuitive point. You know, one of the witnesses said, you know, tongue-in-cheek, you know, I don't think any heterosexual couple that's been married is going to say, oh, well, Gertrude, you know, we've had a really good run, but now that Bob and Ted down the street can get married, you know, we have to throw in the towel. But rather than just leave it at that, what they did is that they got a demographer, Lee Badgett, who'd actually studied this issue in the Netherlands, where same-sex marriage was first legalized. And in 2001, marriage was legalized. And what Cooper tried to show was that there was a steady decline in the marriage rate after 2001. But the key word there was steady. In other words, he wasn't able to show any causal link in between the inauguration or introduction of same-sex marriage and the decline of opposite-sex marriage.
So it didn't take a precipitous decline at that point.
It was just far from precipitous. It was like a straight line. I mean, she said this is about as straight a line as you'll see in any demographic measure. And he at one point said, well, there's a red line at 2001. Wasn't there more of a decline after that? And then she said, if you took out that red line around 2001 when marriage was legalized and you flipped this chart around and showed it to the audience, the gallery, no one would be able to tell when same-sex marriage was legalized in the Netherlands. And then he quickly moved on. So that suggests that he didn't have an answer to that.
Well, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. A lot of emails and tweets as well. And again, Kenji Shino is our guest in this hour of Radio Times. We're talking about same-sex marriage and his new book called Speak Now, Marriage Equality on Trial, the story of Hollingsworth v. Perry. And that's the case decided in California, coming up against Proposition 8, raising a whole host of questions about popular votes and the role and place of courts in making some of these very important decisions. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. Stay with us. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking with Kenji Yoshino about his new book, Speak Now, Marriage Equality on Trial, the story of Hollingsworth v. Perry. And I do want to read some comments that we have here, but I also want to get to this procreation, the child part of this argument that's been going on for some time now.
Yes. So the second argument that the Chuck Cooper side, the defenders of opposite-sex marriage and bans on same-sex marriage were offering was that gay parents are worse than straight parents, just to shuck it down to the bone. And really what the plaintiff's attorneys stated was that every major professional association that has anything to do with the interests of children has come out in favor of the idea that there's no difference between same-sex couples and opposite-sex couples with regard to child-rearing capacity. So the American Medical Association, the American Academy of Pediatrics, American Psychological Association, the American Psychiatric Association, the National Association of Social Workers, every major organization has come out in favor of gay parenting and also of same-sex marriage. Because, you know, I love trials so much and I was talking about the value of trials in this book, I should also note that every parenting decision has come out in favor of the fact that gay parents are just as good as straight parents. So even in red-purple-ish states like Arkansas or in Florida, courts that have been dealing with gay parenting, gay foster parenting, gay adoption have all said, you know, after holding trials, that the evidence was all on one side with regard to saying that gay parents are equally able to raise, you know, healthy, stable, well-adjusted children as their heterosexual counterparts.
Is someone a bigot if they oppose same-sex marriage?
No, I really want to get away from this. And I get criticized for this as not being sort of rock-ribbed enough to sort of point a finger and say you're a bigot, right? Because I just feel like this really misunderstands both the constitutional standard and what the standard should be. In other words, I think the constitutional standard is correct. So the constitutional word is animus, is
yes,
not sufficient to sustain a law. And that sounds awfully like calling somebody a bigot, admittedly. But if you look at the cases in which animus or some cognate of it is in play, it's usually just misunderstanding of a group or a stereotype about a group or discomfort about a group. And that's not bigotry under my definition, which is like an irrational prejudice or hatred towards a group. So just to give you some concrete examples, like there's a 1973 case where Congress said we're not going to give food stamps to hippies, right? And then there was a 1985 case where a municipality said we're not going to allow under zoning laws, group homes to be built in a particular area for people with intelligence disabilities. So if you look at those cases, both of which were, you know, animus or some cognate cases that were both struck down, right, where the laws were struck down, I don't think Congress was bigoted towards hippies. Like, I don't think this was like torch-wielding villagers going after hippies, right? And I don't think people were bigoted against people who had intelligence disabilities. I just think that there was a lack of understanding, a lack of familiarity, you know, just a discomfort with the group, right? So here, too, I would say that, you know, it's just that people need to be sort of better informed. They need to have these studies in front of them. They need to have the results of these trials in front of them. And even the judges, frankly, in the Arkansas and Florida cases, both of them, particularly the Arkansas judge, Timothy Fox, said, you know, this trial has been an enormous education, both for me and for the people who have participated in it. You know, for anyone who wants to learn more about this issue and educate themselves, I would just refer you to the transcript. Because once you look at the transcript, there's only really one way that you can go.
We were talking before the show began, and you said some research of the last couple of years about that 87% of Americans approve interracial marriage. And this was decided by the courts a generation or two ago, obviously meaning that 13% in the year 2015 don't approve interracial marriage. Is that animus, or is that just this is the small subset of people that have prejudices?
Yeah, so that's interesting, and I think that, you know, this is a fair point. So in 1967, as you say, Loving versus Virginia was decided, making interracial marriage constitutionally the law of the land, or you were allowed to enter into an interracial marriage in all 50 states after Loving versus Virginia. Still, in I think it was 2013, Marty, there's a Gallup poll that said 87% of people approve of black-white marriages, meaning that 13% didn't, right? Which is kind of and I always use this as a kind of morale booster, right, for people who are for same-sex marriage, who say, oh, we only have 60% support, you know, which is to say we don't need to get to 100 people. Like, we only need to get...
87 is good enough.
Yeah, like, you know, it's pretty well established in this country that interracial marriage is, you know, a positive thing, even if we only have 87% of people saying in polls that it's a positive thing. So if we want to get to the same norm, all we need to do is to jump up 27%, not 40%.
We have an email from Neil. He says, please ask the guest why he thinks the courts are the best forum for hashing out this issue, the view of the adversarial nature of our judicial system. And this is one of the things that you end your book with, which is to say for, I guess, some of these very specific cases that involve legislative issues, the courts either is or certainly can be a place to hash it out.
Yes. And I want to be really clear about what I mean by legislative issues. The term that I use is legislative facts, and it's a horrible misnomer, and I wouldn't use it if the courts before me hadn't used it. And obviously, legislative facts are not facts that are better left to legislatures or that legislatures decide. They just tend to be cases that arc over multiple scenarios. So just to give you an example, a so-called adjudicative fact is, was a light red or was a light green or was the signature true or was the signature forged? Whereas a legislative fact would be, and as a term of art, would be, you know, do underage drivers tend to run red lights more than overage drivers? Or are people good at discerning whether or not a signature is forged or true or not? So things that are broad sort of social facts about the world. And in fact, some people have used the social facts terminology in order to describe this kind of fact. So to the great question, why do I think that courts are better than legislatures at determining this? It really does have to do with a number of factors, not just the adversarial process, but things that flow out of the adversarial process. So it's the rigor, the thing that I was talking about earlier with cross-examination under oath for open-ended periods of time, all recorded by a transcript, which can happen, right, in legislative hearings, but usually doesn't, right? It's comprehensiveness. it's civility, right? That the judge, you're not allowed to talk to each other. So you're only allowed to talk to the judge, right? And the judge has to stay there, right? Whereas committee members actually, as we know, sort of wander in and out of legislative hearings, right? It's the human dimension of it insofar as individuals are often representative of larger ideas in the courtroom, right? And then finally, and this may seem like a bit of a cheat, but I think that it's a real thing. The drama of a trial is different from the drama of a legislative hearing. We have many, many works of literature, many, many works of art about trials, but very few about legislative hearings. So they tend to serve this educative purpose. So that's not the purpose of holding a trial, of course, but it's what an economist would call a positive externality or a positive knockoff effect, right? Where you amplify the educative value of trials because they're so dramatic in nature that people want to memorialize them.
Well, I'm thinking of a Pennsylvania case that was decided, I don't know, about a decade ago. This is a Kitzmiller v. Dover. And again, it was a federal judge that ruled on intelligent design. We did a couple of shows about it. In fact, we had the judge on talking about the case. But do you see some parallels here?
Oh, I'm so delighted that you raised that.
It's a fascinating case as well.
Yeah.
Very dramatic.
Total kudos to you for bringing that up, because that's exactly one of the cases that I looked at that seemed to be the case that was most like this case. So just for your listeners who might not be as up to speed on this as you are, the Kitzmiller case was a 2005 case that was decided in a district court, and the issue was whether or not intelligent design was discernibly different from creationism. So we know from longstanding Supreme Court precedent that creationism cannot be taught in public schools. And so the question was, is intelligent design just a rebranding, old wine in new bottles, such that it would also not be permissible under the Establishment Clause? Or is it really something that is more based in science and therefore permissible in a way that pure creationism would not be permissible? And the judge said similarly, right, this is not a theoretical debate. This is a debate that we can settle empirically by getting experts on both sides. So I think his trial went on for weeks, ultimately he decided that there was no difference after listening to both the scientific and the religious experts on both sides between intelligent design and creationism. And that's a wonderful model of how trials can work. So again, I was saying, regardless of what your priors are about where the most democratically legitimate conversation is happening, let's leave that to one side for a second. Let's think about where the most rigorous conversation is happening. I think that we can have a debate about the first question, but I don't think we can have a debate about the second question. I think that the most rigorous question always happens in court if you're comparing governmental bodies.
Well, let me go back to some of our email comments. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join our conversation. We have a tweet from John. He says, the 14th Amendment was so long ago. How did it take until now to be applied to legal protection for equal marriage?
I mean,
basically saying,
also a great
what
question.
Took so long?
Yeah. So, you know, this question, that was a very polite way of asking the question, I think, so thank you. More hostile way of asking the question is, how could they possibly have meant to protect sexual orientation back in 1868 when they ratified the 14th Amendment? And my answer really begins with the fact that the 14th Amendment says no state shall deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws. So the 13th Amendment and the 15th Amendment both talk about race or slavery or color, right? But the 14th Amendment, which could have restricted itself to race and was roughly contemporaneous with the 13th and the 15th Amendment, does not restrict itself to race. So why did the framers jump up to a higher level of generality saying, we're going to just talk about equality as an ideal? And my answer to that is that they intended, as they did with liberty, to leave that idea to successive generations and the intelligence of successive generations to figure out what these principles meant in their own time, right? And then the narrower legal answer is that even if a particular institution is innocent when it was created, as I believe marriage was, like, I don't think marriage was created with the intention to box out gay people because gay people didn't even exist in social understanding at the time. An institution can be maintained for illicit purposes. So again, to give an example, there's a 1982 case called Rogers versus Lodge, where there's an at-large voting system, and the at-large voting system was innocent. There's nothing in it that was prejudiced against blacks. But in 1982, the Supreme Court said, but this is actually being maintained right, in order to ace out blacks from getting elected office. And so even though it was innocent in its origins, if it's being deployed and maintained in order to keep blacks out of the electoral process, that is an equal protection violation. So similarly, when people say, isn't marriage innocent? I say, well, I totally admit that marriage was innocent in its origins. But if you look at this more recent spate of marriage laws, right, mm-hmm. clearly they were enacted against a backdrop of worries about same-sex marriage becoming legal. And so I think that we can treat them in a different way under the Equal Protection Clause.
You mentioned Ireland. Interesting, I believe the first country in the world where there was a popular vote for same-sex marriage. But as you write in this book, kind of reminding us for millions of people around the world, they live in countries where same-sex marriage or even being gay is illegal, some even punishable by death.
Exactly. So there are 200 countries in the world that do not have same-sex marriage. So even if the court does the right thing, you know, this June, we're still only at 10% of nations in the globe that have same-sex marriage. As you say, 70 countries still criminalize same-sex sexual intimacy. And in at least 8 of those countries, same-sex sexual intimacy is punishable by death, right? And so we still have a long way to go. We're at the beginning of this journey. I'm actually about to get on a plane later this week to go to Hong Kong and to India to talk about these issues. And I think that the battleground is really shifting to the international sphere.
Your book is called Speak Now, and at a marriage ceremony, I don't know, most people write their ceremonies these days, but in the sort of old traditional way, with Speak Now or Forever Hold Your Peace, if you object to this couple getting married. We're almost out of time here, but why did you want that to be the title of your book?
So thank you for letting me end on this. Ron and I, my husband and I, understood that is usually left out of marriage ceremonies, but we deliberately left it in because we knew that there were lots of people in the world who would want to stand up and object to our marriage on principled grounds. Fortunately, no one did at our ceremony, but we wanted to remind, you know, the people who were kind enough to attend our ceremony that this was still a hotly contested issue. But I titled my book this because I feel like we are at the Speak Now moment in our movement, right? So we're in our movement at the same place that the Speak Now moment occupies in a particular marriage ceremony, which is that in this country, at least, we're approaching the end game. And if there are objections, people need to make them now, right? Or forever hold their peace.
Did you think as a young person growing up that you'd be able to marry and have children?
No, I always joke about the fact that I wear a tie to work. And when I was asked about this, I said it's because law is an honorable profession. And when someone said, why do you think law is an honorable profession? I had to think about it. And my answer was that, you know, every time I needed a door to open in my life, Marty, you know, the law opened it. So when I came out, you know, the law said sodomy statutes are on the way out. So you will no longer be deemed a criminal for engaging in romantic behavior with someone of the same sex. When I wanted to get married, Connecticut allowed us to marry, as we talked about at the top of the hour. And then finally, when we wanted to have children, adoption laws and surrogacy laws were such that we could create a family. And so I've been completely inoculated, for good or for ill, against the capacity to be cynical about the law, because law has transformed my life. And it's now the life where I don't have without the law, I would not have a husband or a daughter or a son. And it's now that life that seems unimaginable.
And I have to say to our listeners, and you're wearing a very nice suit. Kenji Yoshino, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you so much, Marty. It's always a joy.
Interesting hour discussing such important issues. And again, he's Kenji Yoshino, Chief Justice Earl Warren Professor of Constitutional Law at the New York University School of Law. We didn't have time to talk about his professorship. And again, we've been talking about his new book called Speak Now, Marriage Equality on Trial, the story of Hollingsworth v. Perry. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes and you can find out much more about this program. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Thanks for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back.